From the home of the codebreakers and the birthplace of modern computing, this is the Bletchley Park podcast.
We find ourselves outside Block C on another cold December day. This is becoming an annual tradition. Every December, we look back over another amazing year at Bletchley Park for the Christmas special or the December episode of the Bletchley Park podcast. We join you as we look back over Bletchley Park's best ever year. Now, to put it into context, in 2014, the whole of 2014, 196,000 people came to visit Bletchley Park and discover the secret world of World War II codebreaking. This year, so far, with nearly a month still to go, the figure is well over 250,000 and racing towards 300,000 people. And it's no wonder. New exhibitions that opened this year include The Road to Bletchley Park, about codebreaking during World War I, and the little-known story of one of World War II's forgotten heroes, Gordon Welchman. Among the treasures which went on show for the first time were secret notes found stuffed into the roof cracks, discovered during the restoration of Hut 6, and the story of men who drowned stealing vital code books from a sinking U-boat will open soon in Naval Codebreaking Hut 8. Let's take a look back through this amazing year. To do just that, I'm joined by podcast producer Mark Cotton, who's met some incredible people through the podcast this year. Mark, cast your mind back as we walk into Block C and tell me about some of the people you've met this year.
It's been the veterans for me this year. I mean, especially at the reunion. It was our busiest reunion ever. How many veterans did we have in total? It was over 90, wasn't it?
Yes.
Okay, good morning, veterans. Good morning. Are we all sitting comfortably? Wonderful. If you can see the camera, then you'll be in the picture. So I'm going to take a few, and I'll give you the nod when I'm going to do it, okay?
Just wait for one more.
Still one more.
He's on the way up now.
We're waiting for one more of your colleagues. Does anybody know any songs? Choose a song, have a sing. Okay, 3, 2, 1, smile. Just going to check those, have a little look-see, bear with. That's brilliant. Thank you very much indeed. Enjoy your day.
Man with lots of slips of paper, with groups of, I'm trying to remember actually, groups of letters all the way across the whole thing, with groups of 4 or 5 letters, the whole big slip. And then we had a code thing that we had to work out on, which so many down.
Bartram Robinson. And I've been for quite a few years. The place now is immaculate, isn't it?
It is. It's really picked up. I haven't been for quite a few months now, and I've noticed how much lovelier it looks and how much more welcoming it is.
Mm. Yeah.
And over this Veterans Day, they've turned the volunteers out in great numbers, haven't they? And
they have, yes.
I've really, set it out.
So what did you do?
I was an engineer at Hanslope, yeah. We built what became the successor to Tibex, which was RockX. But when you think about it, there was less than about 150 of us there, engineers, and there was 10,000 here at Bletchley Park. So the chances of me finding somebody from Hanslope Park are very, very slim now. But I'll try it. But I'm hoping I'm going to see somebody. I look at some of these old chaps, I wonder, are you? And then you see the badge. I mean, I'm 91 and a half.
What a nice day. I've never been to one of these before. So I'm very glad about the Y Station's hut.
Yeah.
How was Edinburgh?
Oh, great. We had over 300 people, which was nice. And they're a very nice audience. And they all stood up and applauded at the end. And that was great. And we enjoyed ourselves. And then Tessa and I think Ruth and I are going to do the Cheltenham Book Festival.
Oh, brilliant.
In October.
Wow.
So it goes on.
What are you doing now? Are you going to get something to eat or something?
I'm due on a veterans tour.
Have you ever done that? Shall we walk you over there?
Yes. I don't have to.
Friends and family that they brought with them were in greater number this year as well, starting to hand the baton down to the next generation, as evidenced by the way people are joining the community we're creating of veterans' families around the world.
And when the veterans come with their families, it's the pride in their faces, isn't it?
Well, you can be proud of something you've done yourself, but you won't be a fraction as proud of it as your kids will be. And that's what we're really starting to see come to the fore now. The absolute glow of pride in those sons, daughters, granddaughters and grandsons. Who was it in particular that sticks out for you?
It was the fact that we managed to get five veterans who'd never spoken publicly about what they'd done during the war. And especially for me was a lady called Flo Cole, because she'd never spoken to anyone. She hadn't thought she'd been important. And during the interview, you could actually hear the moment where she realised that she had done something important.
I'm going to blow our trumpet a little bit as the Bletchley Park podcast, because that's something I think we only get by being an official podcast and part of this organisation. People will talk to Bletchley Park and allow us to publicise it in a way that is slightly less scary than speaking on television or radio or to a newspaper. And protective as we are of our veterans at those events and every other event, in terms of not wanting them to be press ganged as such, there's a gentle balance, isn't there? When you spotted Flo and you knew she had a great story to tell, it took some tweaking, didn't it, out of her?
I mean, neither of us push the veterans into an interview if they don't want one, do we? But I think especially with Flo, I could tell there was a longing in her to actually tell the story. Mm. And what actually helped was the podcast, because Elizabeth Marshall, who you interviewed last year, came over just at that moment. And one of the things you've probably noticed with the veterans, they all wear a big name badge and they tend to walk up to each other and stare at each other's name badges and, oh, who are you? Where did you work? And because Elizabeth did that, it gave me that in, because I could say to Flo, oh, Flo, here's Elizabeth. She's already done a podcast interview with us. And Elizabeth was straight off saying, oh, it's brilliant. It was really good. You're not the lady who came to interview me. But of course, that was you. Oh. And that got Flo to give me the interview. And it was a beautiful interview.
Well, it gets to their family in a way that perhaps a written record might not, or something in the role of honour. It's another way of reaching people. So let's embrace.
Well, Flo's daughter said to me that she's tried most of her adult life to get her mum to talk about what she did during the war, and she wouldn't, and we managed to get her to do that.
Ah, but she told you. She told that nice young man from Bletchley Park.
There we go. And do you like to be Florence or Flo?
Flo.
Flo.
Everyone call me Flo.
Did you pick the WAF?
Well, it was a bit difficult at the time because I'd got two brothers in the RAF, which were called up, and I was very upset when I had to go to be registered, and all they could offer me was to be in the army. Oh dear, I thought, strangely enough, I just said, oh, I can't go in the army. My brothers are in the Air Force. So I said, I'm sorry, hang on, I've got to go home and ask my mother whether. And when I got home, my mother said, definitely not the army. You've got to go and follow your brothers.
Well, your brothers wouldn't have let you live it down, would they?
Oh, dear. So I said to my mother, could you come with me? Because I was scared. She said, oh, don't be silly. Just go back and tell them your mother has told me to tell you that you can't go in the army. And I went back and she said, oh, it's you again? And I said, yes. I said, you better change pretty quick. I'm not going in the army. I've got to go. My mother's told me. I can always remember. Anyway, the outcome of it all is I did go in the Air Force. It's awfully difficult. I've tried so hard over the years to try and impose what I feel then and still remember. We were living in another world, really and truly. I find it difficult.
I don't think people today understand how all-encompassing that war was, not just for people serving, but for people at home, on the home front. Everyone was involved, weren't they?
But when I went home on leave, my mother never asked me what I did, and I never told her. And we lived for the day. We never thought of tomorrow.
No.
That was the time we were living in.
And then when I went home on leave, the bombing was terrible. I put up with all that and thinking I was going to have it a bit quiet. But no, it was more so being among all the bombing.
A lot of veterans we have felt at the time, you know, they couldn't see what they were doing, how that was helping the war.
That's very true.
But, you know, you could go home, see that that bombing was happening and know that you were doing something that was was helping.
But when I think back now, it must have been very important. But I've always thought it wasn't.
That's the thing. All of you are so modest.
Well, all these years, I've always felt, yes, I did that. But I've never considered myself important enough to talk and say, I did this or I did that. No, I've been very quiet about it for the last 70 years.
So many of you have. Mm. That's the reason why people now are so in awe of our veterans, because they can't believe that you could do that for 70 years. And every single one of you was important. Every single one of you was a tiny cog in this big machine. From the most famous code breaker down to the tea girl, everyone was important.
I suppose you're right, but I've never felt I was very special or anything like that, because, you know, I don't know. It's just part of the way I feel about it all.
You're all so similar. I haven't heard one bragging veteran ever. You're all so modest.
What a strange thing.
And all I can say is thank you for your service.
Oh, how kind of you to say that. I can look back now and feel, yes, maybe we did contribute a little bit.
Well, you definitely did, and thank you.
This year, Bletchley Park went back further than World War II, 100 years, in fact, to reveal the untold story of code-breaking in World War I and how it paved the way for the successes of the Government Code and Cipher School. The road to Bletchley Park was officially opened on July the 29th by Bletchley Park's royal patron, His Royal Highness the Duke of Kent.
That event, we had a number of relations, didn't we? Especially with it being World War I, their relations, unfortunately, were passed on a long time ago. But it's that link to the next generation, isn't it?
Well, there was one multi-layered family. Nigel de Grey was involved in code-breaking in World War I and here in World War II. And he's one of those key figures that we focused on, like Dilly Knox and Frank Birch, who were involved in both wars. Their stories are kind of where this story was born, and looking back into then widening that research and looking into how it paved the way and the lessons they learned during World War I and their joined up thinking that came from it. So for their grandchildren and great-grandchildren to be able to stand and see that celebrated, it must be very poignant when that person's gone, but here is a lasting memorial.
Well, Michael de Grey talks about seeing the Zimmerman telegram, sat with his mother in the 70s and having to authenticate that it's his grandfather's writing on it.
That must have been quite a moment.
And now here it is on the wall here.
Yeah, fantastic.
One of Britain's first actions of the war was a master stroke of communications sabotage. On the night of the 4th of August 1914, five of Germany's six cables in the English Channel were cut. The sixth cable was redirected to be used by the British to intercept German communications. Britain had already recognised the importance of cable. It encircled the world with lines and ran them only across its own red territories and under the ocean. The all-red line was considered complete by 1911. Not only were UK cables protected from interference, many foreign powers were forced to use Britain's extensive network for their own messaging. Britain was in the ideal position to intercept friends and foes alike.
Hello! Welcome to MO5E. The room is not very big, and there are still two or three more to fit in. Where were you before being recruited to this department?
I was up at Cambridge doing European languages, enjoying rowing, rugby, beer, and playing mahjong.
Here. Let's hope you enjoy deciphering intercepted German wireless messages just as much. But first things first, we must get you a cup of tea.
My relation, as far as the First World War is concerned, was Nigel de Grey, my grandfather, a decoder, one of many old Etonians chosen to decode. And so that was what he did. Of course, I didn't know anything about that until 1973, or that just after 1973, I think, when either Mr. Khan or his representative who wrote the book, The Codebreakers, came to our house and asked us to identify his writing. The bit of paper that he showed us was, as I now know, the Zimmermann telegram, and it was in German, and there were letters written in English above a number of the words and phrases, and my mother and I were asked whether we recognised Nigel de Grey's writing on that paper, and we both said without hesitation, that is his writing. And although there were other people's writing on it as well, it was clear to us that the substance, the main part of it, was in his writing, and that, as is now known, he was the person who was the main decoder of the Zimmermann telegram. And this is what brought the Americans into the war. And as my grandfather is reputed to have said at a meeting in the office a few days later, once the Americans joined the war, ladies and gentlemen, the toast is America, because now we are going to win the war. If there's one thing you can say is that my grandfather did something life-saving for our country. What would have happened if they hadn't decoded that telegram?
Very unusual message. It doesn't seem to follow the standard patterns of naval terminology. Codes can be so damn tricky to break without a crypt. A practice code. Sent by the operator, perhaps. A poem?
I'm Candy Connolly. I'm A.G. Denniston's granddaughter.
And I'm Judith Finch, and he's my grandfather as well.
Very proud and amazingly fortunate to be sitting in this office of his. The first big envoy of the Americans came to this room before Pearl Harbor, before there was an official relationship for code sharing and code breaking. When you see Bletchley Park becoming so strong in our modern history and in modern life, and now brings us the technology that we use every day, that connection is amazing.
By the time the war ended, MI1B employed just under 90 people. Britain had become a world leader in the field of intelligence. In 1919, Alistair Denniston, a Room 40 linguist and codebreaker, headed a carefully selected group of Room 40 and MI1B employees, forming the new Government Code and Cipher School, which continued to ply its trade through the 1920s and 30s, before Denniston brought his team here to Bletchley Park at the advent of the Second World War.
It was a freezing cold January day when press photographers asked some of our veterans to pose outside the iconic mansion. Never mind how cold it was, I don't think you'd have even seen them through the freezing fog, no. If you recall. Inside that day, we were privy to secrets that had been held close for at least 30 years by a group of women who included a former ballerina, a convent girl, and a student of German literature, as well as the debutantes of Bletchley Park, as named in the title, The Debs of Bletchley Park. Now, we gathered with seven of those stalwarts of secrecy in the mansion to help them share their memories with the world's media.
OK, ladies and gentlemen, we're ready now. I'm sorry to keep you waiting, but obviously the stars of the show are the ladies, not me. So I'm going to introduce them in a minute. What I want really to say is that in this book, I wanted to describe the war through the eyes of the women. First of all, Lady Marion Body, who worked on Japanese codes in a fairly complex way, in the sense that she had to make sure the intercept stations were taking all of the right signals to get all of the messages, because one station would send on one frequency, another station would reply on another frequency, and you needed both sides. She insists it was very boring, but she also, of course, famously worked with the Duchess of Cambridge's grandmother and great aunt. They were close friends. They'd been recruited from the same secretarial college. Next to her is Jean Pitt Lewis, who was one of Dilly's girls. This is amazing for us because Dilly was one of the great codebreakers here, and he surrounded himself with women, largely because he didn't like the testosterone of the new young men who were coming in and wanted to do everything their way. Dilly was very set in his ways, and he knew what he was doing. So, thankfully, Alistair Denniston, who was in charge, decided he should have his own unit and surrounded him with women. And thankfully, that helps my book, of course, but it also means that we've got one of Dilly's girls here, Jean Pitt-Lewis. And next to her, we have one of our star veterans, I have to say. Betty Webb has been here so often and done so many wonderful things for us, and we're very grateful. And Betty worked on Japanese codes, but she also worked here in the mansion on German police codes, which was an important thing because that told us the start of the Holocaust. Now we have two women who worked in the Numeri. They worked in one of the star exhibits here, the Colossus computer. They worked the world's first digital electronic computer, which is just up the road in the National Museum of Computing, rebuilt by Tony Sale. Marigold Freeman Atwood and Margaret Mortimer both worked on this. And Jean Cocker worked in the naval section. She worked on a huge plot of the whole world, which had all of the German, Japanese, Italian, and British, and American, and Russian ships on it. Every Allied ship, every enemy ship was on there. And obviously, they're plotting it for the war, but one of the key things for some of the women here who had boyfriends on ships going across dangerous waters was that the women in the plot were able to tell them that the ship was still safe. Please put your hand up and say who you are and which organization.
What stood out for me that day was listening to the veterans get to know each other. These were generally, seven almost random women from within the organisation. The point is, they didn't work together. They'd never met each other. It was interesting to see it through the eyes of people who come to the story new, as it always is. In the case that day, the media that attended, it was a really popular launch because there was an opportunity to interview these women directly, that they couldn't grasp the idea of just how big an operation this was. 9,500 people here. So, of course, seven women 70 years later, picked almost at random, wouldn't have been likely to have known each other. But for them to meet each other was a great journey of discovery for them. It made the day worthwhile. Aside from sharing their stories, they got to hear from their colleagues that they'd never even known existed.
Yeah, so we had two Colossus operators. You'd think, oh, well, they'll definitely know each other. They didn't. They worked on different watches.
Yep. With all of our veterans, it's genderless. There just happen to be more women than men. They come to life when they remember those stories.
Oh, they do, yeah.
And they've unlocked it. And that's been quite difficult for a lot of them because they were told to put it away and not think about it and certainly not talk about it. And they all did. They all did exactly that for at least 30 years. And some of them still find it quite difficult.
Every time we have a launch like this and there's veterans there, the press still are amazed, aren't they, by them keeping this secret.
It feels each time like the first time these people have spoken about what they've done. Not to put too fine a point in it, some of them have told their stories quite a lot and in a way that we very much appreciate. Not proliferated and not famous by any means, but certainly not telling their story for the first time, but it just shows you there's always a fresh audience.
Yeah. And the thing that people don't understand is that at the end of the war, they just wanted to get on with their lives. And that's one of the reasons why they didn't talk about things.
Whatever you did during the war, I imagine, and the sense I get is that you wanted to put it behind you and you wanted to get on, and the nation as a whole wanted to leave that period of their lives behind. It's difficult to remember what something feels like when it's only just finished. It's very different than what it feels like 10, 15, 20, 70 years later.
I'm here with Michael Smith, the author of The Debs of Bletchley Park and Other Stories. What made you write this book?
I was asked to write a book on the Debs of Bletchley Park, and I said no, because there weren't that many. People talk about the Debs as if they were all Debs. They weren't. But I will write a book on the women of Bletchley Park, because I think that their story is important. I think we see everything, because of the era that we're talking about, we see everything from a male perspective, because that's the way the world was seen in those days. We always talk about the women at Bletchley Park being small cogs in a much bigger machine, and that's true to some extent, but if you take the cogs out, the machine doesn't work. Everything they did was just as important within the whole thing. And, of course, some of the women were, in fact, leading co-breakers, and at every level, a large number of the people doing the job were women. And the further you went down from the top co-breaker level, the more women were doing it, and the majority of people doing that job were women.
I think I did know pretty well what we were supposed to be doing. Of course, you couldn't get the whole picture, but the word ultra was the code word that we used, and when I was typing out signals ready to be sent all over the world, they were all marked ultra, and that was a word you must never use again, because it only applied to electrical. So, of course it was difficult, and we never spoke, even as we came over to this room and had a cup of coffee, we wouldn't have spoken about what we were doing. And in fact, when you left your room, you always shut the door very firmly and quickly, and you never, ever visited any other room. So there was very little opportunity to find out what was going, but yes, I did know the principle of it.
You talked a little bit about your interview with Dilly. Can we just sort of go over that a little bit? So how did you get called up for that interview? Did you receive a letter?
You see, I just cannot remember. I think it must have been something that my parents organised, because my mother was very involved with the women's section of the British Legion, and my father was a doctor, and he had a big country practice. And of course, Dilly came from Bucks, as did I. And my father also, he had a patient whose daughter worked here, Phyllida Cross.
Oh, I see.
So whether that is the connection, I simply don't know.
So where did this interview take place?
It took place in my home, my parents' house. As I say in the book, actually, that Michael quoted, I didn't get off to a very good start because I was still in bed when Dilly arrived. I think he must have arrived much earlier than expected. I had a terrible cold. I mean, normally, being a doctor's daughter, we were told, don't fuss, get on with it sort of thing, but my mother had taken pity on me. So I wasn't really quite prepared. But I don't remember an awful lot about the interview, because Dilly can be wonderfully vague himself.
The veil of secrecy was lifted in July 1975, and it just so happened that I was in the street in Birmingham, and one of the former Bletchley members was walking up the other side of the street, and she just said, "It's out." I said, "What's out?" And she said, "Well, you can now talk about Bletchley." So I said, "Oh," but I didn't. And it was many, many years after that that I felt free to speak, although officially I was free to speak. As with many of us, my parents never knew, because they both died well before 1975. And it's something which you might think is difficult to do, but having signed the Official Secrets Act, and you know that you mustn't say anything, you do keep it to yourself, even though it's quite hard work when you're 18 and you haven't experienced anything like it before. But I just said to myself, "Betty, you keep everything inside here, and that's the end of it. There is no question."
Working on Colossus, I suppose it was more the environment you would remember, the poor lighting and the smell and things.
The smell, the hard floor, the permanent electric light, because that blackout was always over the windows, and general heat, because, I mean, with all those valves and so on, it gave up quite a bit of heat. We all had to have good eyesight. There were no glasses or anything like that. Then we all had to be a certain height to be able to reach up and do things.
Oh, of course, yeah.
But apart from that, I think they said you should have taken school cert with a credit in maths. Well, that was a total waste of time. You didn't need a credit in maths or anything else. But anyway, I suppose that just meant you'd had a certain length of education, at least, you know, minimum. But
so in reality, you were one of the world's first computer operators.
And last, in my case, I haven't got a computer. Well, I suppose we were. We didn't know that at the time. It didn't mean anything to us. It was just this machine. It was called Colossus, and we worked. all these other things have come out much, much later. In fact, I'm still learning heaps all the time. And I do think it's important that the memory should go on and not be wiped out, because it really was terribly important to the war effort.
After kind of a lifetime of secrecy, is it now a relief that you can talk more about it, or has it just become second nature to not talk about it?
It became second nature when you shut the door and came off watch. That was it, a curtain came down. Even to your best friends, even if you were taking a walk in the park at Woburn Abbey, you would never, ever mention what you were doing. And we didn't until my great friend Catherine Payton, also a Wren of Bletchley, was running her own bookshop. She rang me up and she said, "We're selling a book on Bletchley. Do you think we could tell our mothers now what we were doing?" So we did.
And did you ever sneak out and get down to London or things like that?
All the time, yes.
Did you?
Yes. The dodge was to find a stopping train, and one that was followed fairly quickly by another. So you could stop at one of the little stations on the way to London, I forget what they were called, or on the way to Oxford. One called Parsley Hay I used to use on the way to Oxford. And you had to make sure there was another train coming along behind. You got out, you changed out of your uniform, you stuffed it in the manger, put on your glad rags, which you brought in a plastic, or the equivalent of a plastic bag, and went up to London all glamorous for your evening out. But of course it depended on being certain that on the way back the train would, the same operation yes. could be repeated.
There was ladies that came back on the milk train, weren't
Straight into work, park, yes, yes, absolutely.
And looking a little bit too glamorous for
yes,
a day.
Yes, absolutely, but luckily a lot of the officers said they had no idea what we got up to. It was part of the fun, really.
And do you look back in general that it was fun?
I look back that it was fun, and I look back at the fact that whatever other nonsense I'd made, I did once do something valuable for my country.
Your service was invaluable, and yes. Thank you so much for your service.
Well, you know, it was lucky that we came to such an unusual and really rather sparkly place, even though we weren't allowed to see much of it. It was fun being here. The vibes were very good.
Now, as you walk up to the mansion, you can peer through the windows and see in the drawing room, beautifully restored room, back to its original Victorian mansion condition, as it was circa 1940, beautifully decked out in French turquoise, I believe the colour is called.
Yes.
We discovered. And back in September, we uncovered the story of a man whose vision of traffic analysis prefigured cloud computing, if you can get your head around that.
That's the creaky door.
Forgotten genius Gordon Welchman is now the subject of a fascinating exhibition in the drawing room, as well as a BBC documentary, which has now been seen by more than 20 million people. And this was another example of family pride.
We now realise that Bletchley Park had become as forceful a part of Britain's defences as the Army, Navy.
In this room, we now tell the story of a man who was arguably as important as Alan Turing, but is very little known. And there are many people about whom you could say that, who worked at Bletchley Park and achieved incredible things. Gordon Welchman went on to have trouble sharing his story after the veil of secrecy was lifted because of the sensitivity of what he worked on and its continuing importance. So it's not just a story about the war, it's a story about what happened to him later as well. It's fascinating.
The biography written about him recently is named The Architect.
The Architect of Ultra Intelligence, because of his visionary work on traffic analysis and thinking bigger and realising it needed to be an industrialised system, to put it very simply.
It wasn't just breaking a message, it was knowing where those messages were coming from and who they were going to, and it was learning those networks.
Turning it into a factory operation, yeah. Which upscaled it in a way that almost the scientific creativity of that is quite staggering. His granddaughter, who's an academic herself and has made no small achievement in her life, flew all the way from Canada just specially to see this exhibition open, and it clearly meant the world to her.
and also to get to meet someone who worked with her grandfather.
Jimmy Thirsk is pretty much one of a kind. He's 100 years old, still very sprightly, and he worked in Hut 6 with Gordon Welchman. And his first-hand memories are just like gold dust.
We had a lovely sit-down with Jimmy, Dr. Joel Greenberg, who's the biographer of Gordon Welchman, Jenny Welchman, and Bletchley Park veteran Betty Webb.
Jenny, within the family, I know that Gordon and Tini, his third wife, paid a visit to Britain, and when they saw that the book had been published, he then went back. When he found out about Winterbottom's book, when they got back home to Newburyport, he had a dinner party and told friends, etc. When did the family itself, did he actually formally say anything to the family? When did the family start talking about it?
About the book or
about Bletchley?
About Bletchley. Well, he'd certainly told my father many years ago, and I think at some point, I can't remember when, decided to sit down all the children and tell them a little bit more. But I think it was always my dad who knew probably most about what was going on. I never had a clue until also it was Winterbotham's book, and that made him feel that he could, begin to talk about things. And then all of a sudden, after never having a clue what he did, I didn't even know what he did when he was at MITRE. I had this vague idea he was an architect. Mm-hmm. And then suddenly, we're hearing not only about Hut 6, and of course there was talk about getting people together and who they could contact, because originally Joel's book mentions that the idea was for a joint publication to get several people to come in, and he was only going to write one bit. And it was an amazing transformation. He never talked about Second World War before that, except very occasionally some personal family anecdote. And then suddenly we're hearing all this detail. And he was enjoying it. He was, reliving memories and recalling people whose names he hadn't felt safe saying out loud before, in all those years. So he was having a great time.
Okay, so when the Hut 6 story came out, did you think that Welchman Jimmy had revealed secrets that he shouldn't have revealed? Or?
No, I bought the book when it came out and read it, and it didn't strike me that he'd revealed anything he shouldn't have done, because I knew this background of all these revelations that had been made before, and I couldn't understand what the fuss was about later on.
Oh, it's interesting. Betty, did you feel the same then, that you couldn't understand?
Yes, I did. Well, I felt quite comfortable with it. It didn't bother me at that stage, because I didn't know anything about any other possible deviations.
It was a shock that he got the pushback he did. He was certainly hoping that some people would take a little bit of notice of the book, although I think he expected it to be more a sort of inside response, people who knew something about security. One of the things he'd been concerned about in that period in his career was what he thought was overconfidence that new kinds of computer security, I believe there was the talk about, was it the two-key method, encrypting things, that this was going to solve all problems with security. And he said one of the things he was hoping his book would get across is that it doesn't matter how secure your equipment is. As long as human beings use it, there is no such thing as a secure system, and there will always be things you can find out. So he really had hoped that people would not only read the book for the revelations about Hut 6 and the things that had gone on here, and that people like yourselves would finally get some of the credit you were long overdue for all the wonderful work that people had done here. But he was hoping that people would also think about the implications of what you'd managed to do, which is long before a computer gets built here, you're cracking a network, and hundreds, thousands of messages a day, I suppose. Mm-hmm. But it's by using these other kinds of skills, the traffic analysis or metadata, as Joel points out, it's now called, and all the other techniques that you're using, that those could be used at any time against any system. And with success. He was hoping that would be picked up on. But we didn't expect it to generate the response that it did. That was a very difficult period.
That's been really good chat. It's just wonderful to bring multiple generations together. Gordon Welchman obviously was the reason we were all here today at Bletchley Park. Lovely to have former colleagues of his here, as well as a member of his family.
Yes, that's great.
A lovely gathering to...
It's a pity we haven't something strong to drink.
Yeah.
Oh, that would be nice.
I couldn't agree more.
Welchman.
Yeah, yes, okay. Yes. With water, yes. A little toast, yes. To Gordon Welchman. Yes. Well, sir.
What did you do during the war?
I worked in a radio factory.
What did you really do during the war?
Are you paying attention?
If you speak a word of what I'm about to show you, you will be executed.
It's beautiful.
It's the greatest encryption device in history. The Germans use it for all major communications.
Everyone thinks Enigma is unbreakable.
Let me try, and we'll know for sure.
Mr. Turing, do you know how many have died because of Enigma?
No, I don't.
Three. While we've been having this conversation.
You see a historical film based on a true story. You want to find out more, so you go and see the place where it really happened. And bingo, there's an exhibition giving you exclusive behind-the-scenes access to the film as well. The Imitation Game, the exhibition, was planned to run for a year from the cinema release in November 2014, but it's proved so popular, with around 80% of visitors pouring into the billiard room and ballroom every day to see the sets, costumes and props, it's been given a reprieve, and it's as popular as ever.
Just finally, how yes. important is it, do you think, that Bletchley Park is kept alive and accessible to people?
Hugely important, hugely important. I mean, that was the environment where men and women from all walks of society, from all abilities, whether it be actors and artists to the more likely candidates of mathematicians and physicists and scientific thinkers, came together to try and crack a code, or many codes actually, that were the encryption devices of the Nazis, and they were winning the war. The country was starving, the clock was ticking, as is portrayed in the pacing thriller element of our film. And to understand the importance of that is also to understand the importance of those men and women and the actual environments of where it happened. So to experience something of that through the extraordinary exhibits and explanations you get, both of the working environment and the tools, the actual, you can see the machine, you can hear the machine working. And it's amazing. You think from that came a reading of a code that basically won us the Second World War, some estimate by 2 years, and that meant millions of lives were saved. And it was all done in secret, and now we can look at that secret. So how could that not be one of the most important legacies we have in our culture of that era? It's incredibly important that it keeps going, incredibly important that it's open to the public and something that's well-funded and supported and continues, because this is our history.
The film was nominated for sackloads of awards, but the most notable it took home was the Oscar for Best Adapted Screenplay, which went to an understandably emotional Graham Moore.
And the Oscar goes to Graham Moore, The Imitation Game!
This is the first Oscar and nomination for Graham.
Thank you so much to the Academy and to Oprah for this. I need to shower my love and kisses on everyone who's a part of our Imitation Game family. Morton, Nora, Ido, Teddy, Kira, Benedict, Billy, Alexandra, our entire cast, Maria, who's back there somewhere. I love you guys so much. Thank you for this film. I'm so indebted to you for it. So here's the thing. Alan Turing never got to stand on a stage like this and look out at all of these disconcertingly attractive faces. And I do. And that's the most unfair thing I think I've ever heard. So in this brief time here, what I want to use it to do is to say this. When I was 16 years old, I tried to kill myself because I felt weird and I felt different and I felt like I did not belong. And now I'm standing here, and so I would like for this moment to be for that kid out there who feels like she's weird or she's different or she doesn't fit in anywhere. Yes, you do. I promise you do. You do. Stay weird, stay different, and then when it's your turn and you are standing on the stage, please pass the same message to the next person who comes along. Thank you so much. I love you.
And Graham's not the only one picking up gongs this year. In June, Bletchley Park beat the London Eye, the Eden Project in Cornwall, and the Albert Dock in Liverpool to be crowned Best Attraction for Groups in the 2015 UK Group Travel Awards. Then in October, it was a runner-up in the Best UK Attraction category at the Group Leisure Awards, alongside The Making of Harry Potter, The View from the Shard, and Warwick Castle. The prize went to Portsmouth Historic Dockyard in the end. These accolades bear out the step up in quality Bletchley Park has made as a great day out.
Yeah, well, I mean, I came partly because of the movie, which was, I thought, a very, very good movie, but also because one of our friends here is an excommunicator in the Navy and has often spoken about his code breaking and all that sort of thing. So this, and with the guy Dennis and Barry, our friend, it sort of gave a much, much bigger insight into the movie, which I thought was great.
Made the movie come alive.
Yeah. But it's a fascinating place. It's absolutely fascinating. You have to come again.
Yes, that's it. It's more than a day, isn't it?
Oh, God, definitely. We're coming back again. Yeah. It's only 100 miles from where we live,
though. Oh, well.
I think my experience of it was from time in the Navy, really, and my time in communications, and subsequent to that as well, other work I was doing in computer security.
It must be fascinating for you to see the roots of the work you've done.
Absolutely, the roots is probably the right word, and stuff we did in the Navy.
It sets it in context for you.
Well, I joined the Navy in 63, so it's only like less than 20 years after this. So some of the stuff we were doing and the encryption work we were doing was directly connected in some ways to the work that was done here. We were always taught about traffic analysis and how people can gain the information from traffic analysis if you don't adhere to the right procedures. Because once you start learning about traffic analysis, you realise about the information you can gain from it is amazing, without even decrypting the messages. So it's it's really eye-opening. I've thoroughly enjoyed it. About 8 years ago, I came here, and it wasn't anywhere near what you've got here now. It's amazing the amount of work that's gone into it since then. Yeah.
Back in February, more than 20 members of Alan Turing's family gathered in Hut 11A and launched the fundraising effort for an exhibition which will tell the story of the bomb machines, co-invented by their famous relative, in the very building where they helped speed up the process of finding daily Enigma settings. Some members of the family had never been to Bletchley Park before, and it was quite poignant for them to walk in their famous relative's footsteps. It attracted five separate TV crews as they happened to visit on the day of the BAFTAs.
It's been quite extraordinary, yes. Just had a very large number of members of the family, probably the largest gathering of the clan that we've ever managed to achieve. We've all been here at Bletchley Park having a great day. We've just all been seeing a demo of the rebuilt bomb, so lots of younger members of the family now thoroughly, I think, bewildered about what it was that was going on, but I think they're all quite intrigued. So yeah, it's been good fun.
There was three generations of Turing.
Yes,
here, wasn't there?
Yes, there were. Yes, there's three generations, and lots of the younger generation, which is very nice to see, and including a couple of people who actually remember from their childhood Alan Turing himself. So that's been rather good too.
What really got me was the younger generation actually saying how proud they are to be part of this family.
I know,
and it's lovely,
great.
Isn't it?
It's great, and they're going off now to see other parts of the site and see Alan Turing's office in Hut 8 and things like that, so there's plenty for them to do. It's all very interesting, yeah.
And lots of press here to help with the fundraising for Hut 11A?
Yes, certainly lots of press and lots of family members stepping up to do little interviews and things with the press, which was rather nice. Hopefully the message about Hut 11A and needing to get some money to put the bomb exhibition up and running there, that hopefully has got across today as well.
It'll be a lovely room when it's done.
It will.
It's much bigger.
Yes, it's a nice big space to play with. On a cold day like today, it feels a bit unloved in there. But once we've put a nice exhibition in there and livened it up, then it'll be great.
It gives more room to be able to tell the story. Doesn't
well, it? And I think it means that we can tell the story in a bit more of a sort of slick and visitor-friendly kind of way than we can at the minute. We haven't really got the resources for that where we are right now, and very heavily dependent on the bomb demonstrators, who do a cracking job, by the way. But, I think it will be helpful for them to have it less crowded and to have some aspects of the story presented to visitors in a sort of more varied kind of way. I think that will be good.
Some members of the family were going straight from here to the BAFTA ceremony, in fact, and some of the people you chatted to were having their red carpet moment later that day and actually starting to discover that kind of associated limelight that comes with being related to someone, bizarrely, they've never met because of the accident of history, but who has almost, defining them in a strange way in public consciousness.
I think you've got it exactly right there. It's like they're in this limelight that they never expected.
It's nothing to do with them in a way.
No.
They never met him.
My name is Neville Hunt, and I am the great-nephew of Alan Turing, the son of Shuna Hunt, who is one of the three nieces of Alan Turing. It's been an amazing day today. It's, you know, mixed emotions today in terms of, you know, not my first visit to Bletchley Park. I always enjoy coming back here. It's probably fifth or sixth time now I've been to the park, but the first time with my family. I'm sad that my mum couldn't be here today, but she's preparing herself for the BAFTAs, which we're all very excited about. But no, to be with all my cousins and my two remaining aunts is fantastic. It's been a really great day. And yeah, I'm sort of wishing Bletchley Park all the best with raising some money to get Hut 11 finished. That was a first experience to see that hut, and each time I come, Bletchley seems to have made strides in improving the place, spending money and renovating various huts, and it continues to get better, and I want to come back to see what the next hut is that's completed on the next project. So when friends of mine have been to Bletchley Park and I sort of explain the family connection, you know, it's obviously with a sense of immense pride my great uncle was one of the key people that worked here. But you know, we mustn't forget the other guys that worked here as well. And one of the most, well, perhaps the most emotional moments I had at Bletchley was during the centennial events, where I got the pleasure to meet Asa Briggs, who obviously worked alongside Alan. And that was a very emotional day, and very nice. You know, it was an honour to meet him, and as one of the co-breakers there.
And so you're off to the BAFTAs as well tonight then?
We are. Rachel and myself are going to represent the family along with my mother, Shuna. We were invited by the Studio Canal, and very much looking forward to mingling with the stars. It's a truly one-off experience, once-in-a-lifetime experience. And,
without doubt.
It's very, very exciting indeed.
My name is Rachel Barnes, and I am a great-niece of Alan Turing.
Is it a weird day today?
It is a very, very emotional day, and I'm finding it hard to take it all in, to be honest with you. I mean, what an incredible day to be here with the whole of the Turing family to celebrate Alan Turing's achievements, and also to start this fundraising.
And a long day for you, because after here, you've got somewhere else to go, haven't you?
Yes, I have got a very, very exciting day today. After this interview, I will be getting on a train up to London, and I'm going to the BAFTAs this evening.
Again, because of Alan?
Because of Alan. So, thank you to my great uncle.
Has it been a strange year? Or 6 months since the film came out, I guess, really?
Yes, it has been extremely strange and brilliant, just totally, totally brilliant. I mean, until the release of The Imitation Game, hardly anybody had heard of Alan. And now he is known by almost everybody and is practically a household name. So, yes, it's been fantastic for Alan Turing's legacy and very moving for the whole of the family.
What really grabbed me was one younger member of the family who just finished university, and he's going to keep his working life in the family tradition.
My name's Thomas Barnes, and Alan Turing's my great-granduncle.
Yeah, so it's the first time the whole family's come here en masse.
I know, and is it strange? Because basically, the excitement with all these press guys with the cameras and videos and everything, it's because of a member of your family. Is it weird?
Yeah, it does feel quite strange, but no, it's just amazing to be related to such an incredible person, to be honest.
And you've been dining out on it?
Slightly. No, it's amazing. I'm actually studying computing myself, so in a way, Alan just gave me that confidence to go and study computing. It's absolutely fantastic.
Carrying on the family tradition.
Yeah, exactly. Well, apparently I'm the first person to actually do computing after Alan, the family. So yeah, that's quite a big thing. It definitely helped for me to go into computing. I mean, it made me more interested in computing. I mean, from a young age, I was always interested in IT. Whenever I had an IT class at primary school, I got so excited by it. And then my parents were telling me about Alan and how I'm related to him. I was doing so much research on him. I was like, oh my God, I'm actually related to someone like this. So then it just made me want to do even more. And yeah, here I am doing a degree in computing.
What are you hoping to do after your degree?
Well, I'm applying for a lot of jobs at the moment. I'm applying at MI5, so hopefully maybe going to there.
That'd so you amazing. Really want to keep it in the family business?
Yeah, exactly, yeah. It'd be fantastic too.
The
pride of the Turing family shone throughout that day, and the Bletchley Park Trust is now reaching out to veterans' families around the world to join a global community of people with a special link to this unique piece of British history. We're asking veterans' relatives to join by emailing friends@bletchleypark.org.uk. You'll receive an exclusive e-newsletter twice a year and have the chance to buy a commemorative brick honouring your code-breaking relative at a discounted rate of £150. That offer runs until spring in 2016, when it will be widened out to everyone who can buy commemorative bricks for £250. Those bricks will rebuild the blast wall around Naval Code-Breaking Hut 8, and it will give people a chance to honour their relative's contribution in perpetuity.
It's something, pardon the pun, really concrete that people can do, isn't it?
Yeah, well, it's lasting. It's a tribute, a memorial. It's building them into the fabric of this beautifully restored site that is a memorial to these people and what they achieved.
What we do here, and the core reason for us being here, is to tell the story of the codebreakers who were here between 1939 and 1945, isn't it?
And the unique thing about this place is you're not just at a museum about something, you're where it really happened. And so to build memories of those people and feel that pride for generations to come into the very fabric of the restored site, you just can't beat that.
And we've said pride, I don't know how many times in this episode, but I think it's the word of the year, really, isn't it? Because we've met so many families this year, especially. And it is just the utter pride in their faces and in their voices that the listeners can hear when they talk about these relations, because they realise now how important what they did was. Here we are outside Cottage 3, which during the Second World War was where Dilly Knox, the chief codebreaker at Bletchley Park at the start of the war, did his finest work. And with me at the moment, I've got four of Dilly's grandchildren. If I can just get your names.
Dilwyn.
Tim.
Charlotte.
Peter.
I mean, are you proud of what he did? You know,
very
the more
curious.
You discover.
Very curious about it.
But also incredibly proud of all the work that he did. And it's fantastic that so many people are now coming to see this. It may be a beautiful day, but it's also wonderful that so many people are coming.
In the future, we'll be opening up all of this area and we'll be able to tell that story better.
Yes.
Because obviously, as we grow, we get to tell more of the stories and get to celebrate more of the brilliant people who worked here during World War II.
I'm just terribly impressed by how much you've done in such a short time.
Yes. But also all the hard work that people on the ground have been doing, obviously. We're impressed and grateful for.
I find it spine-tingling to walk into the mansion, knowing I'm walking where my grandfather and my father walked but never could tell anyone. And I find it difficult to hold back the tears at a time like that. It means so much. And then suddenly to buy the guidebook today and to find two photographs of my father in it. Thank you for giving me the opportunity, because I'm just delighted to contribute to this place, which is still far too secret.
It's happening naturally now that it's being passed to that next generation and the one after and the one after to carry that baton of, again, pride in what was achieved here. And we're embracing and celebrating that as we go forward.
So should we go and walk into her tape?
I think
have
we can get in out the rain, yes.
Because a lot's going to happen around and in here over the next year, isn't it? We talk about generations, and there's a school group just leaving Hut 8, so we just step back to let them out.
As we step away from the leaf blur in the background into Hut 8, let's look ahead to what we've got coming soon in this building. An exhibition is opening soon about the pinch of Enigma codebooks from a sinking U-boat, which allowed the codebreakers to end a 10-month blackout on Naval Enigma, saving lives and supplies. The story of the petard pinch shows that codebreaking wasn't all about clever boffins and machines. There was real human sacrifice involved too. Do join us again in 2016 for more secrets yet to be revealed. Thanks to the paid and volunteer staff, veterans and visitors who took part in this podcast. For more information, go to bletchleypark.org.uk, find us on iTunes and Twitter, and join our Facebook group. Thanks to Audio Boom, who make this podcast possible. This podcast is produced for the Bletchley Park Trust by MC Fontaine. And if you like the Bletchley Park podcast, don't be shy, write a review on iTunes. Thanks for listening, and we'll have more decrypts from the home of the Codebreakers next month.